And we are here this week with Red Pill Junkie and Joshua Cutchin for our midweek podcast. And how are you guys doing?
Doing pretty good. Doing pretty good.
Well, my week is getting better. My week is getting better now that I'm joining my friends Soraya and Joshua, you know, for one of our weekly conversations that I missed so much when I was in Phoenix. Well, not so much because I was in such great company, you know, with Greg Bishop and all the people we met at the International UFO Conference.
So tell us about that. How did that go?
Well, it went great. I think, you know, it beat all of our expectations. We managed to do a bit of what you could call guerrilla advertising with Greg Bishop's upcoming book, It Defies Language. We went there carrying a bunch of bookmarks that he printed in LA, and I also brought a couple of posters from the cover that I printed in Mexico. So we went there with the intention of trying to talk about it, leave some of the bookmarks, and discuss the book with people we find at the event, which we did. And also the main purpose, I guess, for making the trip was because we wanted to meet Jacques Vallée, you know, who happened to give not so much a presentation, but a Q&A moment with Lee Spiegel, whom he knew since 1978, when they both were involved in these United Nations hearings that were, you know, tried to organize in order to see if the United Nations would try to create an international effort to study the UFO phenomenon, something that ultimately failed. But so Lee Spiegel and Jacques Vallée were involved in all of that, and then they talked a bit about that, and then Jacques discussed his latest book, Wonders in the Sky, and all the things that he and his co-author Chris Obeck, they intended to portray about that, you know, showing how you can do a really good work, historical work, by researching all these ancient archives. And you can see how in ancient times there were a lot of really smart, intelligent people whom now we will call scientists, but I guess back in those days they went by the name of, by the term of natural philosophers, and they have anomalous sightings of things they saw in the sky and they couldn't explain, and they tried the best to record such a sighting, and their observations are so good that you can really do a lot of interesting work. It's the interesting, almost like detective work, using modern tools like all these software programs that can let you know exactly the night sky in antiquity. You know, you can put on a certain date, a certain time, and it can show you the constellations and all the astronomical phenomena that were going on right at that particular time, and you can use that to ascertain whether what this person was seeing was maybe a comet or maybe a meteor, or if that wasn't the case, then you can really say that that observation was truly anomalous. So he talked about that, and he showed that, you know, despite of what someone like Stephen Hawking and Neil deGrasse Tyson will say today, UFOs are seen regularly by intelligent people, not just cranks and weirdos, you know. In fact, some of the most intelligent people in antiquity happened to have had their own personal UFO sighting. So that's kind of like the sole theme of Under the Sky. Jack Wolfson's this new edition of Wonders in the Sky, which is now a really wonderful hardcover cover, almost like a coffee table book that they printed, decided to go and funded it through a Kickstarter campaign. So he went there also, you know, to offer copies of this new edition to people who might be interested. And, you know, even Greg and I decided to, what the hell, you know, spend $180, I think was what the offer at that moment for this book, which will become almost my most precious material possession when I get my hands on it.
So did you get to at least shake hands with Valet, or did you get to have a share a word or two with him, or?
Yes, we did. We managed to have a very brief private conversation with him. You know, everybody. It was really funny to see all these seasoned UFO researchers turn into giddy fanboys in the presence of Valet. Everybody wanted to have a selfie with him, to have one of his books signed by him. So, yeah, we tried our best to have our, you know, a few minutes of his time talking to him in private, which we did. And it was really something, you know, something that I will never forget, because he really is very courteous, very polite, kind of shy. In fact, I think that he was caught on by surprise when Alejandro Rojas, which is one of the main people of the Open Minds organization, which organizes the International UFO Conference, when they had this ceremony, the Saturday night banquet, when they give these awards, you know, the Investigator of the Year award and the Lifetime Achievement award, Alejandro asked for a round of applause to Jacques, and everybody obviously stood up and gave a big cheer. And I don't think he was expecting that, you know, and almost Alejandro met us when we were talking to him, you know, almost to apologize to him, you know, for doing such a thing, you know, but he felt it was the right thing to do. And I happen to agree. I mean, the man, it's a living legend. I mean, it's the reason why many of the people who were there, maybe giving lectures or signing books, decided to enter this field in the first place.
I would argue that he's one of the few ufologists who, for the public at large, is an easy touchstone. I mean, anyone who has ever seen Close Encounters, you can always say he's the guy that Spielberg based the French ufologist off of, you know. I think that's something that very few ufologists, probably outside of somebody like Giorgio Tsoukalos, who was constantly in the popular culture eye nowadays, really kind of resonate with pop culture in the same way that Valet does.
But here's the other thing about Valet is that he is an astronomer. He is a computer scientist. He is an absolutely brilliant individual. So no one can shoot him down saying, well, this guy's just a kook. I mean, he was inventing search engines back when they were saying that you couldn't use words in search engines. You could only search with numbers.
Yeah.
And he was coming up with ways to do this. I mean, he was way back in the 50s and 60s doing this stuff that we're only now in the last couple of decades actually using on a regular basis. He was so far ahead of the field in that. He was so far ahead of the field in the UFO stuff as well. And he never went out on these crazy limbs like, oh, this is what it is. It was always, here's the data. This is what it suggests to me. Maybe it's this, maybe it's that. He's always been down to earth, rational, and if you read his diaries, his journals, you know, he's always kind of approached it with an I don't know what's happening here, but it's really fascinating and very, again, very down to earth. So I think he is the most stable and, again, down to earth voice of the UFO phenomenon in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I would be inclined to argue that the reason that he is that that stable personality is because he's so good at something else. You know, I think that's what we need. I think we need ufologists who are really good at something else and can bring that sort of mindset to the field.
You know, one of the reasons why I admire him the most is because he probably is one of the few people in this field who was honest enough with himself to actually change his mind.
Yes.
About what the phenomenon may or may not be. I mean,
more than once,
you know, he's probably going to change his mind about the phenomenon, in the future as well. I mean, he started out pretty much in the ETH nuts and bolts camp when he wrote Anatomy of the Phenomenon, but then he went and almost did a complete 180 with Passport to Magonia, and a lot of people really resented that apparently change of heart. That's because Valet is a true scientist, you know, even though maybe you could say that Magonia is not really a scientific book, but he approached it from a scientific methodology because he allowed himself to be led by the evidence he encountered. And most of the people in this field do the complete opposite. They come up with a given explanation, and they try their best to find evidence that supports that opinion.
Yeah. And the other thing is, I mean, if you look at some of the other big heavyweights in the UFO field, people like Whitley Strieber or John Keel, as much respect as you can have for them, they can always be taken down a notch because people will say, oh, well, they're storytellers. You know, Whitley was a fiction writer, so, you know, he could be making it up. And John Keel, well, he was a reporter, so he's stretching the truth because that's what they do. And whether or not that be the case, that's always going to kind of loom over them, whereas Jacques was not any of those things. He was just a scientist.
Well, you could say that people could look at his involvement with Robert Bigelow with some kind of critical eye.
True, but that's much later on in his career.
That is true. Well, and then he was involved with J. Allen Hynek. Now we speak highly of Hynek, but there was a time when, you know, the people in the UFO field, Carl Lorenzen, people in APRO, people in ICAP, saw Hynek as the enemy or almost as a wolf in a sheep clothing because they really couldn't understand why this guy who was involved with Project Blue Book, which they saw as a smokescreen disinformation campaign pulled out by the Air Force, was now changing sides.
Right, but Valet was always critical of Hynek's involvement with Blue Book. And if you read his journals, you see just how critical he was of that whole thing. He didn't agree with what he was doing because Hynek was essentially saying, well, I got to be a part of this in order to get access to the data.
Yeah.
And Valet was like, no, you don't.
One thing I wanted to ask Mr. Valet was something that Greg Bishop wrote about in Project Beta, something that Bill Moore told Greg about J. Allen Hynek. And apparently Hynek was also involved in the whole Benewitz affair and was asked by the Air Force to provide Benewitz with a computer specially programmed to deceive Benewitz when he was trying to decode this, what he thought were alien transmissions coming out from the Kirkwall Air Force Base and the Manzano weapon storage facility. So this was something that apparently Hynek carried out at the behest of the Air Force, whom he was still pretty much in contact with. And I wanted to ask Vale about that, whether this story is true or not, because it really casts a different light about Hynek, you know.
Yeah.
Hynek now is like almost like in the pantheon of ufologists, of, you know, people who, you know, gave their life for the truth, you know, and suffered dearly for it. But I don't know, it seems that if this story is true, it seems that Hynek still remained still a certain amount of loyalty for the Air Force. Maybe because, like you said, he still wanted to be like one of the boys, you know, inside the game in order to receive whatever crumbs of information they would grant him.
And you didn't get to ask him that, unfortunately.
Well, yeah, I got nervous, you know. I mean, it really was overwhelming for me. I think Rick has had met Valet on a number of occasions. And one thing that I want to mention is that when we had this private audience with Valet actually took... had a copy of Project Beta with him and asked Greg to sign it for him.
Nice.
I think that was like the highlight of Greg's, you know, moment, because he really wasn't expecting that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I really felt good for Greg, you know, I mean, that Mr. Valet said, "You must sign this for me."
that's got to be a great feeling.
Yep.
I saw pictures of you from there. I was confused, though. You didn't have the wrestling mask on.
I know. And I did bring it. You know, I actually let Alejandro borrow it, because here's the thing. Alejandro Rojas told me a really funny story. Apparently, some people thought that he was the Red Pill Junkie. Yeah. So first, Greg... it took a picture of the two of us together in the same room to show the world that, you know, we are both different people. But then I decided to have a bit of fun, and I asked Alejandro, you know, to put on the mask, and he came up with a better idea of almost like taking a picture of as if I had caught him at the moment of taking the mask off, you know. And I'm intending to posted it already on his Facebook wall, but I think I'm going to use it on this article I'm planning to write for the Daily Grail about meeting Jacques Vallée and having this kind of like road trip kind of pilgrimage to meeting, you know, one of the patron saints of ufology.
And early on, it was him and John Keel that I always wanted to meet. At least there's still a chance I could meet Valet or talk to him someday, whereas Keel, unfortunately, not the case.
Yeah, I'm not sure if Valet will be ever willing to go to another of these public UFO events. I mean, obviously, he will still go to these non-public UFO events, like the one that was celebrated in France, I think it was in 2014. I think it was 2014 or 2000, or maybe last year. I don't remember. This conference that was organized by the French Space Agency, I think.
That I didn't know anything about.
That was a closed door event, though, wasn't it? It wasn't like a...
Yeah, he said it was private.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Well, not private, like, you know, I mean, secret, you know, like part of the secret
cabal. But just not open to the public.
Exactly, you know, but the same way that scientific workshops are not really open to the public. They are by invitation only.
So, Red Pill Junkie, you brought to our attention this article on Motherboard, which is a part of Vice.com. And it seems to be a site that deals with futurism and technology and science. And it was written by this woman, Sarah Scholes, and it's called "The People Who Believe Electricity Rules the Universe." And it is, you want to tell us how you were involved in this at all? Because you're quoted in this.
Yeah, I guess I was quoted, or, well, not misquoted, but brought out of context, perhaps. I'm not sure. Well, the thing is that, if I remember correctly, by the end of January, I found on my Twitter feed this tweet by someone asking for people who were interested in the electric universe theory, because they were needed for some kind of article. And I replied by saying that I wasn't really that knowledgeable in the EU theory, but I was happy to be of assistance if I could. And then this woman contacted me via email. We decided to run the interview in that method. She sent me 5-6 questions, I guess, very, very, very general, very broad, about the EU theory, what I thought about it, you know, why I chose it over standard physics. And I tried to do my best to show her that I was interested in the electric universe theory, but that I wasn't, right, like, you know, replacing it for the standard model of physics, and that I was trying to remain as neutral and as centered as possible, not really, you know, going to any type of polarizing views over it, because that's what we do at the Daily Grail. We pride ourselves into being one of those few excluded middle sides which deal with this sort of quote-unquote fringe topics. And I felt I had done a pretty good job doing that. She thanked me profusely and told me she would send me the link to the article once it was uploaded. And that was that. I forgot all about it shortly after. Then the last Wednesday night, I received a bunch of news links from one of my friends, Kat, who also collaborates with the Daily Grail, news links that I could use for my Thursday night news briefs, for my Thursday news brief, sorry. And one of those happened to be that motherboard article. So I read it very quickly because I was more interested in trying to finish my news brief than anything else. And I found myself being quoted in it. And then I realized that the tone of the article was really very, very skeptical and very, like, I don't know, shoehorning all the people who might show an interest in the electric universe as crackpots or delusional idiots.
Yeah, it was a very disheartening article, and it's something that I believe Soraya said earlier, I think we all sort of echo the sentiment of, was how it became very clear that there was a definite set way that this was going to be approached in the beginning. It wasn't like the story sort of organically came out of the research. It was very apparent that this was set up to be, you know, kind of a discrediting job to this theory, which, you know, I personally think it's interesting. I don't think necessarily that it's the quote unquote the answer, but I think that there's some strengths to it that I think should have been more prominently featured in that article.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing about the electric universe is that she tried to act like she was giving it a fair shot when she was not only not giving it a fair shot, but she was, how can I put this? She was kind of twisting the facts around just a little bit to make it seem like something it wasn't. She obviously had an agenda going in to make it look silly. She would say things like, well, they don't make predictions when they make predictions all the time. As a matter of fact, when they make predictions, like when we sent a probe to the comet for the first time, They had a whole list of what they expected to find when we landed on this comet. And they were right on like all but like one thing, whereas mainstream science had a list of what they expected to find, and they were wrong on all but like one thing. So to say they don't make predictions is not true. The fact is they're approaching it in a much more down-to-earth way. You know, like they talked about how Wallace will say, well, you don't need mathematics for this type of stuff. And he kind of dismisses it. But his argument is that the way cosmology works today, so much of it is in this disconnected mathematical world. Like, if you can make the math work, that must be reality, rather than actually just observing what's going on. And more you see, I mean, it's been science's stance that there's no electrical involvement in the solar system, which is kind of absurd when you think about it. And they're thinking everything's electrical, but I think there's a truth somewhere in there. And more you see mainstream science saying, oh, we found weird electrical fields here, or we found electricity here, and we don't understand why that is. And it's slowly working its way in. It's never going to just be accepted, but it may eventually, a big chunk of it may end up being in mainstream science eventually.
Yeah, my approach to the electrical universe theory is, I guess, the same approach I'm trying to have with climate change, which is also a very polarizing and nowadays a very controversial topic. Now, if you say that you are a skeptic of climate change, then people think of you as anti-science, right? You're a denialist, you think it's all a hoax and whatever. But my current position is, yes, there is a climate change. You know, I even say that it's global warming. But I also think that we should consider the possibility, or should consider the influence that the sun has in the way that climate is changing. That obviously, human activity has an influence on the climate. You know, all the pollutants we throw into the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide and the methane and whatnot. But we should also consider the possibility that there are other factors we may not be taking into account. And I think the same should go for this thing about electrical discharges happening in outer space. I mean, okay, you know, maybe it's not like these guys say that, you know, everything can be explained through electricity, but surely it might have some kind of influence that could very well explain some of the things that we are observing in the universe.
And the problem with dark matter and stuff like that is also, you know, like she was talking about how the electric universe dismisses all of that. And she's like acting like that's a ridiculous thing to do. But when you think about it, you know, they put this theory together of dark matter and dark energy because their theories don't work. So they're just like, yeah, the math doesn't add up. What can we add into it so the math adds up? So they come up with dark matter and dark energy and say, well, if this stuff exists and the math adds up, and they've been looking for it forever. And every time they say, well, this test is going to prove dark matter, and it doesn't. Over and over, their tests fail 100%. And instead of saying, well, maybe our theory's wrong, they go, well, no. We know our theory's right. We just have to find it. And that shouldn't be the way science moves forward.
Yeah. I was actually the guy who used that phrase that dark matter and dark energy seemed like patches into the current cosmological model. You know, so she used that from me, you know, and I have to agree, you know. I mean, it's not like I'm saying, these scientists are deluding themselves, but it does seem that they are trying their best to explain away all these unexplained phenomena in the universe and coming up with these ideas, which they are also trying to find them to the theory to coincide with the observations. And so far, it seems that they aren't coinciding. So, yeah, I mean,
this is something that should be taken into account. I mean, the problem is if you go into this approach, you are considered a woo-woo or someone who has a mistrust in authority. And I guess, well, yeah, I mean, there's probably some of that in our field, but with good reason.
I don't believe anything blindly. I mean, I am a skeptic. I question everything. It doesn't matter what source it comes from. You were going to say something, Josh?
Well, my real standpoint is that it's this idea that there's this great Charles Fort quote that I love, which is that science is a turtle that says that its shell encloses all things, which is really what we're looking at here. We're looking at like any belief system, particularly those of the faith-based persuasion. It's saying that, okay, these are the parameters that we set out, and we're not going to entertain any ideas that might possibly be outside of them. And it's just such a backwards way of looking at it. But one point in the article that really, really bugged me, was after your quote, RPJ, the author said, well, while it's true, that's a good point that sometimes fringe ideas are adopted by science. Most fringe ideas are just, you know, are cockamamie, which to me is really missing the point. The point is that science of today looks so unlike what it did 100, 150 years ago. Not that every idea that we have now was once a fringe idea, but the fact is that everything does change. Things get turned on their head, things get upended. And at every juncture, scientists have always thought that they have the answers and that we're proceeding from this point on and there will be no great revolutions to what we're discovering. And that's just not the case. So, you know, to say that, most fringe ideas are usually unproven doesn't mean that it doesn't mean that you shouldn't at least entertain the possibility that some other models might be a more parsimonious and effective way of explaining the nature of reality.
The other thing is too that she says where is this here? The electric universe is a solution in search of a problem. It seeks to explain things that we already understand very well through gravity, plasma, nuclear physics. But that's not necessarily true. There's a lot of problems with this. We don't even understand how gravity works or what it is. I mean, we have theories, but none of them are actually proven. And it's one of those things where it's like, okay, so, you know, these people are crackpots because they are questioning what we don't actually know, but we pretend we know. And she's also leaving out the fact that so many of the people supporting this are physicists and cosmologists and people who have deep scientific backgrounds. This is not a bunch of people who don't know anything about this stuff joining together and saying, yeah, this sounds good. They have so many scientists that are backing this. It's not like a small minor thing, like there's one scientist and everyone else is novices and unenlightened.
But it's definitely presented that way in the article. Yes. I mean, she starts invoking the word cult gets invoked.
Yes.
At least one point, which is just absurd. And speaking to the point of, well, you know, science can explain this. Science. Our current model can explain this and can explain this. So therefore, any other model is false. Well, you know, I might be able to have certain words filled in a crossword puzzle and I can use two different words. That answers, you know, that solves the riddle. And it certainly accounts for the letters that I have down. But it might not be the right answer that solves everything, you know. You might have pieces of it figured out, but you might not have, there might be an alternative model that actually explains things that haven't been accounted for, like, you know, things like dark energy.
Right. And they, you know, she goes after Velikovsky as well, who, I mean, has been a target for, 66 years now. And a lot of his stuff, and Lance, wow, where'd I get Lance from? What's his name? Wrote all the stuff on the Dogon.
I know who you're talking about, but his name is escaping me.
Laird Scranton?
Thank you, Laird Scranton. Actually, after I had just read Velikovsky's World is in Collision, I thought, well, this is 1950. I wonder how the science has held up and if it's ever been, you know, routinely disproven. And then, you know, Laird puts out this book on Velikovsky, Checking the Science. And he said when he went into it, he thought, well, he's probably going to find that current science disproves Velikovsky's theories. And he went through and said, nope, actually, current science holds up everything Velikovsky said. And he went through and noted every article, every paper that showed that the things Velikovsky said to expect and made predictions about all turned out to be right. But we don't like his idea, so we're still not going to accept it.
Yeah, well,
there
was certainly a really nasty moral judgment present in the tone of the article. The idea that, if you show any kind of interest into these sorts of controversial topics, like the electric universe theory, then you might end up being not only an anti-vaxxer and a climate change nihilist, yeah, you end up to be a dangerous someone who is going to, if allowed, you're going to end up, killing Jews, yeah, in a second Holocaust. Because obviously people who did that during the World War II were trying to justify themselves with really pseudoscientific, theories that were labeled with a label of social Darwinism.
And it refers to everyone who has interest in the electric universe theory as Thunderbolts, because that's the name of the page and what they titled some of the work, Thunderbolts of the Gods. But it says, and I guess this is probably your quote, Red Pill, where it says, Thunderbolts hate the question mark terms that modern astronomers use, dark energy, dark matter, to describe observations they can't explain yet. They call these concepts patches.
Yeah. That's probably something that he come up with after reading my answers. Yeah.
But the thing is, they're treating your answers as if you speak for everybody in Thunderbolts or anyone who's interested in the EU, which, is what you do when you're trying to demonize something.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is that I'm not even a member of the Thunderbolts forum.
Well, and the thing that that really gets me up in arms, I have a master's in journalism, and I've seen the way that sausage is made, and it's quite disconcerting to see how sometimes the simpler narrative is chosen, and it's a real thing. Like when my first day in, I'm like, I'm going to write something that's going to be really cool, and they're like, no, bring it down, simplify it. And that's too complex of a through line. You needed to make it a little bit simpler and a little bit more grounded. And it really is a shame. But I think, anybody who's listening can really see this reflected. If you've ever been, I have never been quoted for a newspaper story or something, or been featured in a story. I've been featured for music and for some other stuff. Never, ever, ever have I not been misrepresented in some capacity by media. If it's a quote, or if it's getting my hometown wrong, or if it's a quote that I said that's wrong, it happens all the time. And I think part of that's human error. I think part of that sometimes is a streamlining. But I think sometimes it just really shaves off any sense of nuance. And that's what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with nuance. We're dealing with people who are critical thinkers. And when you're trying to convey, people who value those virtues in a story like this, and at the same time present this clear through line, it loses a lot.
Yeah. It's basically a hit piece on the electric universe.
Yeah.
Now, granted, there are parts of the electric universe where I'm very skeptical and where I'm thinking, okay, I don't know about that. But they make enough good points where it should seriously at least be considered. One of the interesting things I find really interesting about it is the idea that Venus started out as a comet. Robert Schock has, when I talked to him and I asked him about it, he said, yeah, it's definitely a possibility. It's not the one he necessarily ascribes to, but it is a possibility for what ended the last ice age. And when you have Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson and everyone coming out saying, well, these were comets that, you know, came down and hit, ended the Ice Age, caused the Younger Dryas and then ended the Ice Age. Those comets could have been associated with Venus. There's absolutely no reason that they couldn't be. And Robert Schacht thinks it was a massive ejection from the sun that did it, and which is also a possibility. But if you look at some of the evidence they have collected for Venus, for instance, in the old legends, you have Venus at war and Mars going to war. Well, in their electrical model, two planets couldn't hit one another. They would come close. They'd have an electrical discharge, which is what's called the thunderbolts of the gods. And then mm-hmm. they'd separate. They wouldn't actually collide. So when you look at Mars and you see the scarring patterns on Mars, they can recreate those in a laboratory using plasma discharge. And they look exactly like the scars on Mars. So when you consider that, it's like, okay, this is at least, if nothing else, food for thought, because we know it wasn't carved out by water, and scientists will tell you they don't know how that scarring occurred, but here you have the EU people going, we do, and we can demonstrate it in the lab.
Yeah, I mean, I just lost my train of thought.
The other interesting thing, and Schacht also uses this as part of his argument for a solar outburst, is that you have these plasma symbols that are found worldwide. And I forget the scientist who actually noticed this, but he was a plasma scientist, and he was looking at these ancient carvings and stuff, and he started realizing these are plasma outbursts. Schacht attributes it to a blast from the sun, again, like a massive solar flare, which could cause this. The EU people attribute it to Venus coming closer to the Earth. And out of the different formations that plasma can take if it's in the atmosphere, the only ones that were not present were the ones that would give off deadly radiation that would kill you instantly if you saw them. You have this all across the world carved into ancient sites. So this is not coincidence. They saw something. Something happened that they saw these formations in the atmosphere and recorded them.
Oh, I remember what I wanted to say. You know, the article posed an interesting conundrum, because Sarah Scholes also interviewed Phil Plate, the astronomer who runs the very popular Bad Astronomy blog. And let me tell you, I happen to like Phil Plate. I follow him on Twitter. I think he is a very worthy science communicator. And he also obviously is involved with the skeptical community, not as much as he used to. I think that at one point he was actually the guy who try to convince the skeptical community to follow the "don't be a dick" policy, right? So that's why I respect him. But obviously, some of the things that he said or he was quoted saying in that article is that scientists don't even bother to address people like the electrical universe proponents because they know how all that phenomena is run by gravity and by nuclear forces and whatnot. So they just, you know, don't even acknowledge their presence.
Yeah.
And it's an what I say is it's an interesting conundrum, because I wonder if by doing that they actually give people who are proponing a different thing, they actually give them more power, you know, by not addressing them. I think that there is this guy, Bill Nye, the science guy, who mm-hmm. actually goes the other way. You know, he actually likes to engage people who are against the standard scientific models, you know, people like creationists,
right?
So he goes into these debates and whatnot, and so it's an interesting position whether science should
not even bother to give all these theories, some of which obviously are really delusional. I mean, I think that we can honestly say that the idea that the world is only 6,000
yeah.
years old is not even wrong, as you know, quoting some famous scientists. But so that's why I'm saying it's a conundrum. I mean, what should a scientist do? Should a scientist not even bother to address these ideas, or should he try to engage these ideas? But by doing so, teach the controversy position, and some people fear that it gives those other heretical ideas equal ground, and that is unfair, because they don't have as much weight or as much evidence or as much validity as our current orthodox views. I don't know, what do you think, guys?
Joshua?
Well, I feel like it would, part of me doesn't even, I don't know, I've gotten to the point where I've gotten so cynical on science engaging with some of these things that I kind of just want to say, go ahead and just do your thing. Let us do our thing. And then, the truth will out years and years down the road. In terms of folks like Bill Nye, who do actually engage, I feel like when they do, a lot of times they're going for the lowest hanging fruit. I think somebody like Bill Nye debating creationists is, it's almost like it's pitting the strong against the weak in a lot of ways. Yeah, and I wish that there would be somebody who has a more skeptical idea, who can actually debate folks like Bill Nye, and not necessarily from a creationist point of view or whatever, but I for example, I would love to see Randall Carlson and Bill Nye talk about the driving forces of climate change. Randall suggesting that there are certain extraterrestrial impacts that can affect it, and other geologic forces, versus the current simply man-made climate change position that Bill Nye endorses. I personally have a hybrid view of those two things. But I would love to see him really engage with someone who is his equal, just from a different perspective. But that's not going to happen, because I don't even think that the establishment is too cowardly to engage with people like that. I just think they don't even take the time to seek them out.
True. And when it comes to climate change, I think all three of us are kind of on the same page, where it's impossible that man-made activities can't be affecting the environment. I mean, everything affects everything else. You don't pour tons of pollution into stuff and not have an effect on it. It doesn't just go away.
Yep.
But at the same time, I think the sun and natural cycles are also what's driving the massive amount of climate change that we're going through. And as Joshua and I were talking before we started this, if we go through and clean everything up and it turns out that's not what's causing climate change at all, well, we still cleaned everything up, so we're not really losing anything. I mean, it's a win-win situation,
right? And even if there's a proverb, I forget which culture it's from, but it says, no matter how far you are down the wrong road, it's never too late to turn around, or always turn around. Even if it is man-made, go ahead and turn the ship around. But I think there's room for a more nuanced discussion to be had. That's the reason that I've gravitated towards this community, is that I feel like people involved in these sort of subjects do have a more nuanced view than people in the establishment. But, so much of our society now is completely binary. It's not endorsing that excluded middle, as RPJ said. We just don't talk about that anymore. I mean, look at the election. Jeez.
Yeah. Well, everything has to be.
She also... she also brought up the issue of GMOs, right?
Yeah.
And saying that, oh, people who mistrust GMOs are the cause that people are starving to death in Africa. And it's like, well, I mean, we could feed all those children in Africa if we wanted to.
Yeah.
I mean, with all the food that is wasted in industrialized nations,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I myself, I'm not against GMOs per se, you know, I mean, for the sake of it. I mean, I think there are things we could do to try to manipulate the genetics of plants and even, animals in order to improve or boost some of the characteristics we think are more desirable. But, I mean, we've been doing this for millennia, and, you know, GMOs will be a way to do it quicker. And obviously, well, there is also the risk, you know, of always rushing to something, you know, thinking that we know what the outcome will be, when most of the time it's not the case. But what I'm against, the thing that rubs me the wrong way about GMOs is that it basically gives companies like Monsanto, you know, this monopoly on the things that we need to have for our subsistence, right? I mean, to give companies the copyright of, you know, the precious foodstuffs that humanity depends on, it's something that we might end up regretting in the long run.
Well, too, when you look at something like GM foods, there are positive things we can do with genetically modified things. We can make them so that they, you know, we weed out certain strains that are more prone to diseases and stuff. But when you get to some of the stuff Monsanto's doing, you know, they make Terminator seeds that can't be replanted. You have to keep buying it from them, unlike natural seeds.
Yes.
And they charge an exorbitant amount for them. And there are people in India, there's a number of articles I'd read where these farmers in India who have been killing themselves because they've bought into the Monsanto thing. The seeds didn't mm-hmm. do well. They didn't make any money. They didn't have money to buy more seeds. They can't reuse the Terminator seeds. And they commit suicide because they're failures and they don't know what else to do. There's also incidents where Monsanto have sued people because their seeds have taken over their fields, even though they didn't plant them there. And they're like, well, you know, our seeds are in your fields. You're now liable for it. And we're going to sue you because you didn't have the right to have those growing there.
Oh, man.
So, I mean, Monsanto is to me, that's sort of the face of evil corporatism.
Yeah.
And someone really needs to rein that in before it's too late, before we don't have any natural seeds left, because that will be a disaster of epic proportions if all we have are genetically modified crops that you have to manufacture every time you want seeds.
Yeah, not to mention all the pesticides they develop that have cost all these horrible die-offs of bee populations, you know, the bees that we need to pollinate a lot of our crops.
Yeah. And they knew it. And they knew it. And they bought the first company that came out and said, look, it's this pesticide killing the bees. They bought the company and crushed the study.
Yeah, the same thing that when these tobacco companies, you know, they killed... They buried all those studies showing that, you know, tobacco caused cancer, you know, cigarettes.
Go on.
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, but the thing that boggles my mind is, and I do understand that it's a reaction to some of the more dangerous anti-scientific establishment trends that we're seeing, like climate denial, like the anti-vaccine movement. But you know, at the same time, when has questioning things ever really been a bad thing? And not even talking about like abandoning commonly held beliefs, but just like bringing up alternate possibilities. When has that ever been a bad thing? In fact, most of the time it's a good thing. And I feel like when you don't question things, certain developments, certain ideas, certain theories, you wind up really painting yourself into a corner and setting yourself up for what could be a really bad situation where you're left with no other options.
And what this article is essentially trying to do by bringing up GMOs and stuff, it's like, oh, well, you know, if you believe in the electric universe theory, you might as well be anti-GMO and anti-climate change. And it's like, these are totally different things. You know, just because someone believes in one thing doesn't mean they're going to not believe in these other things, you know?
Yeah.
It's like guilt by association. Oh, these are other fringe things that people believe, and they could be considered bad, so this is bad too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like in the Daily Grail community, there are members who think that 9/11 was an inside job, you know, and think of it as a false flag. I don't happen to agree with them, but we know that we have built this space on the internet, the Daily Grail, in which those ideas can be discussed, even fiercely discussed and debated, but without evolving into ad hominem attacks, you know, into belittling or accusing or insulting the person who doesn't happen to agree with your point of view.
Right, right. And that's what everything should be. If you have to insult someone that doesn't agree with you, you don't have a good foot to stand on. And that's unfortunately what so much stuff devolves into. It's like, well, I don't agree with your conspiracy theory. Well, you're blind and you're of course, overhyped term sheeple. You're just, you know, you're a sheeple and you need to wake up. And it's like, how about you talk to them in a sensible way and present your argument and let them decide for themselves?
Another great Charles Fort quote that I'm quite fond of is, "The outrageous is the reasonable if introduced politely."
Yeah, I mean, that's the strength of the internet. The thing that, I mean, discussions and commenting and interaction can be had and should be fostered. And that's why I don't understand why the people of Vice and Motherboard decided not to have a comment section on that page.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I did as well.
They were probably afraid of all those cultists coming after them.
Exactly. I mean, the Talbot minions, you know, the thundervolting.
We might have mentioned this earlier, but is this Thunderbolt term really bandied about that much in EU theory? This is the first I had heard of it.
The page that presents the majority of the stuff is thunderbolts.org. The term that kind of set it all off was Thunderbolts of the Gods. So it gets nicknamed Thunderbolts as well as EU and stuff like that, just as a reference point. But I don't think anyone calls themselves Thunderbolts, you know. It's not like, I believe in the electric universe, I am a Thunderbolt, you know. But if you want to sound more like a cult, you give them a name like that. Well,
that's exactly where I was going. It's a way of sort of dehumanizing people or a way of pejoratively making fun of them.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's exactly what it was, because I've never seen references like that in that terminology.
And, you know, honestly, I'm not even entirely sure how much of we keep on painting the author as possibly having some sort of nefarious motives. I think it's almost the here controversial statement of the night. I think it's almost the scientific equivalent of institutional racism. You know, it's almost like we don't even realize that we're being, you know, that we're being unfair, you know, in terms of this. It's just in the system. It's just in there to go ahead and dismiss people and to make fun of and marginalize people like this.
Yeah, well, I don't think that she went in with a nefarious motive. I think she went in believing that she was right and the EU people are wrong, and she was going to write an article about how. Rather than saying, what's this electric universe thing about? Let's see and keep an open mind. She went in with that preconceived conception. And when you do that, nothing good really comes of it, because no one's going to, how can I put this? It's like true believers versus the the debunkers. You know, it's not useful. It doesn't further the conversation. And of course, she's not trying to further the conversation. She's trying to kill it. Because she knows that science is right, and that means the EU people are wrong, and they're just cranks.
Because, yeah, exactly. Because we're working back from the assumption that we've got it all figured out, and that we're on the 100% on the right track, which is smacks to me of hubris.
Yes, and when you look at certain things, like, for instance, the surface of the sun is significantly hotter than the inside of the sun. And if you ask any scientists why, they can't tell you. They don't know, because it doesn't make any sense. From an electrical universe standpoint, they can tell you why that is. Whether they're right or not, I don't know, but at least they can explain it. So you can't say that EU can't explain things that we already can explain with accepted science, because there's so much stuff out there we have no idea about.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of reminds me of how astronomy in ancient times had managed to figure out to a really good degree, I mean, the movement of the planets, you know, and by that, you know, predicting eclipses, you know.
Right.
But the explanation they had back in those days was that the planets were inside these kind of like giant crystal spheres that caused what they called epicycles, you know. Epicycles through epicycles, you know, and that explanation, you know, is obviously nonsense, but it managed to actually work, you know, from a, you know, empirical point of view, you know. I wonder if the same goes to many of the things that we think that we have managed to figure out, you know, I mean, the nuclear aspect of fusion stars, you know, the gravity's involvement in the orbit of the planets and all that, and the curving of space-time. I mean, we have to realize that the two most important theories in modern physics, which is relativity and quantum physics, remain pretty much separated, you know, by this giant gulf, because we haven't managed to join it together. And that is a really big, big problem in modern physics.
Well, and I think, you know, to sort of build off that, it's this is a problem that we have in a lot of places. I'm convinced that if you look, science is great, and if I need to be treated for an illness, I want the doctors to have a good knowledge of how my body works. I feel like it can explain a lot of things, but I feel like if you just start scratching the surface on a lot of things, it becomes very apparent that we don't have a real firm grasp on the way a lot of things work. I mean, I find it hard. It pushes my personal BS meter to hear things about things working on the quantum level or distant heavenly bodies, when we don't really even know how we sleep, or no, not how we sleep, but why we sleep, like the exact reason. It's still not pinned down. Now, I know that we're talking about apples and oranges here, but I'm saying it seems like there's so many basic things that we haven't figured out, and yet we can extrapolate very elaborate models of things that we will, for all intents and purposes, are not going to be able to visit probably within the next, you know, 200 years. We're not going to go to be within any reasonable distance of a black hole, and yet we posit a lot of this knowledge, and there are sound foundations for the reasons that these conclusions have been reached, but I still feel like there might be something bigger that we're missing.
So one of the reasons Alex Sakaris titled his book Everything, or Science is Wrong About Just About Everything, or whatever, however he phrased it, was not because he had a problem so much with the scientific method and some of the things discovered by it, but that they were leaving, you know, things like consciousness out of the equation and just trying to work around it. Thus, by default, they were wrong on some level. Right. And at the same time, you could say that a square peg can fit in a round hole if the round hole is big enough, and then it seems like, oh yeah, that fits there, when it doesn't. The other thing, and you mentioned black holes, and one of the things I learned from reading the Thunderbolt site they will say they attest that there are no such thing as black holes. And they talk about rapidly spinning plasma formations. And these, if I'm not mistaken, these are actually somewhat accepted on some level by science. They can be recreated in the lab. They know what kind of X-rays and gamma rays they give off. And so whenever you see a thing that says, you know, such and such black hole discovered, I always read them because I'm interested to see what the evidence is.
Right.
And almost always the evidence are these X-rays and gamma rays that can be proven in the lab to be given off by these rapidly spinning plasma formations. So as I look through it, trying to look at exactly what they found, all they've really found are these X-rays and gamma rays, and that's it. And they say, well, we don't know what this comes from. And literally the way this came down is they said, we don't know what these come from. It must be a black hole. And that's their proof that we found black holes. So every time you see black hole discovered, they didn't see something. They didn't have evidence that it's a black hole. What they had is gamma rays and X-rays. They can't explain, thus, black hole.
That's a much better way of putting it than I said. A much better way.
I mean, she interviewed Phil Plait, who is an astronomer. I wonder why she didn't decide to approach a plasma physicist.
Yeah. Well, because, you know, she just wanted things to buffer out her opinion that it was all nonsense.
Yeah. Let's be honest. I mean, writing an article for the internet, sometimes it takes a lot of work, a lot of effort, and it doesn't really get paid as well as if you write an article for the New York Times.
Sure, so, if at all.
If at all, yeah. So I might give her some slack for that, you know, that I know that it's very, very difficult to write a comprehensive essay, an article on the internet on those accounts, you know.
But it.
But yeah, I think that if she had given the people whom she quoted, you know, the chance to review the article before it was published and say, well, you know, I don't agree with this and this and this. I don't know. I'm not really sure how she could have tried to be more objective, even if she already had, you know, kind of made up her mind that, you know, the electric universe theory is all a bunch of woo-woo. I don't know. I mean, I did see her trying to say that the people who believe in the electric universe theory, although misguided, are thoughtful and curious and, you know, and interesting in all these big questions, you know. So she tried to give those, brownie points, you know, to all these people, and myself included, I guess. But
but the thing is, it's not really about this article. It's about the way these subjects get treated in general. Exactly. It's like the article's just an example of what you've been seeing forever.
Yeah, it's a very good example of the typical way that these topics are represented.
You know, whether it be UFOs or whatever, if you see an article written on a mainstream site about UFOs, they don't look at the intricacies. They don't look at, okay, well, something's obviously happening. What is it? They say, oh, are aliens visiting us? Well, these people seem like crackpots, and there you go. You know, and it's like, what?
Yep. You know, which reminds me of something that happened during the trip to Phoenix, you know. On our first day, we went to this really interesting place called Malkalpine, which is kind of a weird mix between a traditional soda fountain, and also a thrift store. You know, so after we had lunch and after we had this wonderful, you know, ice cream soda, we decided to hang out there for a while, you know, just looking at stuff. And I found this really old copy of a volume of this aerospace encyclopedia, you know, Earth and Space Encyclopedia that was published in 1968. And I was, as I was browsing through the pages, I found a chapter about unidentified flying objects. And what's interesting to me was that the article was actually very, very open-minded. You know, it gave the pros and cons why, you know, UFOs could be, you know, extraterrestrial craft, you know, visiting our planet. And so it was pleasantly neutral. You know, I wish Sarah Scholl's article about the electrical universe had followed that kind of journalistic neutrality. But I guess, you know, things have changed in science journalism. And science journalists are not as open-minded as they used to.
Yeah, well, that's true of all journalism, I think. You know, you don't get the news, you get the news with a spin.
Yeah, and it didn't used to be that way. I think that has a lot to do with the more intensified profit-motivated approach that news has taken in the last 20, 30 years.
Yeah, that's very true. All right, well, anything else we should go into before we end this?
Okay, so this is really nerdy, and I thought it was a bigger deal than apparently anybody else did, because my social media response to this has been kind of underwhelming. But I found it interesting. So there's this new version of The Jungle Book coming out, directed by John Favreau, and all the environments, it was like filmed like literally in a soundstage. It's all digital environments and all digital animals. It looks beautiful. But what's interesting is that Favreau was approached with the fact that the realization that King Louis in the animated version of The Jungle Book that Disney originally did was an orangutan, and there are no orangutans in India. But he still wanted to have this character of King Louis. So what Favreau decided to do is he has decided to depict King Louis as a Gigantopithecus. I just read this in an article today, and it blew my mind because, you know, I remember seeing in the ad, I'm like, wow, King Louis looks huge. And that's because he literally is depicting King Louis. He's gone on the record saying that he's depicting King Louis as a relic Gigantopithecus, which was really fascinating to me because I feel like this is the first time that we've ever seen Gigantopithecus being depicted as itself. You know, this is probably the first big budget depiction of a Gigantopithecus in film. And of course, the reason for anybody who's not hip to this fact that this is interesting is because a lot of Sasquatch enthusiasts believe that perhaps a relict population of Gigantopithecus is a good candidate for what Sasquatch might be, or at least descendants of that species. So it's really interesting to me that this basically we're getting a big budget Bigfoot in the Jungle Book movie.
Nice.
Neither here nor there. Kind of a complete non sequitur from the rest of our conversation, but a little bit of a lighter note to end it on, I guess.
Very good. All right. Hey, when's your book coming out, Josh?
Oh, I don't know. It's a great question. About half of my readers are done with it, and so I'm going to get their edits back, and I'm going to sort of process them. And I have the plan to get it off to Patrick Weege at Anomalous Books by the end of March. So I wouldn't expect anything probably before June or July, but this summer is the answer. It's
all right. Okay. You want to point anyone to anything, Red Pill?
No, not really. I mean, I'm planning to write some article about my experience at the International UFO Congress. And after that, hopefully I will try to finally get to all the other things that I've been keeping in my blogging backbone, as it were, you know, on Mysterious Universe.
Nice. All right. Well, thanks, guys. A pleasure as always. And we'll talk again soon.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, man.